the man in the front who comes to the meditation practice from Britain. We're looking at all the various kind of contributing factors, the things that make it possible, but and now we finally get to the real meditation master. And this is the very well known Anapana Sati Sutra, and it explains basically how the practice of mindfulness or breathing is undertaken and how it actually works. So, and it's very interesting. And one of the, again, one of the things to always look out for when we look at these things is to decide how important is a particular exposition, how important is a particular sutta. And again, this particular sutta, the Anapanasati, is something that you see throughout the Nikayas. You see in many different places, there is even an Anapanasati Sanyutta, a collection of discourses on mindfulness of breathing. And it occurs in various places, in the Majjhima Nikaya and a few places, etc., etc. So it is one of those core things on the Buddhist path, and again, it is found also in all the various traditions, the various schools, the various languages, and all of that. So it is a core part of Buddhism, and for this reason, I think very interesting. So let's just have a quick look at the opening paragraph here, then, and see what it has to say. Because when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness, the four applications of mindfulness. When the four applications of mindfulness are well developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of awakening. When the seven factors of awakening are developed and cultivated, they fulfill an insight and liberation. So that is just the opening statement that promises what it promises. Yeah? And I like the way it always said at the beginning, it is of great fruit and great benefit. And what that means is that it takes you all the way to Arahantship. So the Buddha is normally quite low key. He doesn't kind of exaggerate. He uses kind of slight understatement. When he says great fruit, remember, it really means really great fruit. It means the absolute highest fruit. That's what he means by that. And this is one of the things to take into account when you read the sutras. And the Buddha says, okay. Excellent. Okay. This is one of the things to remember when you read the sutras, that the Buddha tends to be quite understated. He says something is happiness, it means like the highest happiness, or something is liberated, it means the highest liberation. Yeah? It doesn't usually exaggerate or add also adjectives and things like that. So keep that in mind. So when the, for example, in the third jhana, the Buddha says something like, you get to the third jhana, the one who dwells in this way in the third jhana, that person experiences happiness. Sounds quite ordinary, but actually, that can mean the highest kind of happiness, so, which is kind of interesting. You don't get any higher experience or happy feeling than you do in the third jhana. So this is interesting. So here you see what happens when you develop mindfulness of breathing. And the first thing that happens here is that you fulfill the four applications, or the four establishments of mindfulness. These are the satipatthanas. This already, I think, is very interesting, because it is not optimally obvious how we are supposed to practice satipatthana. And if you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, and you look at the various exercises, the various things that you're supposed to do in there, sometimes you wonder, how is this supposed to be done? And a good example is where it talks about the Vedana Vipassana, the contemplation of feelings, whether it's positive, negative, or neutral. It always says is that you do it this way. You know when the feeling is a worldly feeling or otherworldly feeling. You know if the feeling is how does it go again? Sorry? Present, but neutral, exactly, world and unworld, this kind of thing. So that's all it says. It says that we know the, basically we know the feelings. So it doesn't say anything about the context. It doesn't say about how you do it. It doesn't say whether you do it when you're walking and sitting, or when you do it, you know, in some other. So it's very open to interpretation. So when we look at the sutta this way, we ask ourselves, is there anywhere a broader understanding of this? Do we find anywhere where actually we can explain this in more detail? And yes, that's exactly what you do. You find that in the Anapanasati Sutta. Here the Buddha explains to you exactly how you're supposed to contemplate these feelings. It is through the practice of Anapanasati. So, because it is so broad, because it kind of allows so many interpretations, the Satipatthana Sutta, it also tends to end up people use many different methods and ways of doing this. So, for example, the Guenka tradition, they interpret that meaning you just contemplate the feelings in the body. That's the main thing, how they interpret that. So first of all, you watch the breath, then you contemplate the feelings in the body. And that sequence, watching the breath first, and then contemplating the body, is based on how this exposition is found in the Anapanasati, in the Satipatthana Sutta. Because in the Satipatthana Sutta, you find the four first steps of the breath meditation, you find here. That is under Kaya Nupasana, yeah? And then you find that afterwards comes under Veda Nupasana. But that's why you watch the breath first, and then you watch the feelings in the body. That's how they interpret that. But that's just an interpretation. And I always find it much more interesting to find out how does the Buddha interpret these things? What does the Buddha say is the ideal way of practicing mindfulness or practicing meditation? And from the Buddhist point of view, it doesn't work like that. All you have to do is watch the breath. If I do that, you are fulfilling all of these things. Veda Nipasana, Chitta Nipasana, everything else is fulfilled as a consequence. It makes it very easy, it makes it very straightforward. It takes away a lot of the difficulties of interpreting these things. Chitta Nipasana is similar to the Veda Nipasana. All it says is that you know the various mind states, you know the mind with desire, without desire, with anger, without anger, with delusion, without delusion, mind which is kind of great, mahakata chitta, all these kind of things. So you know that it doesn't, again, doesn't say that you know how to do that. Now the Anapanasati Sutta gives us the key to understanding how it is done. It's done through the mindfulness of being with it. So for this reason, I think it is a very crucial sutta, and it also simplifies things. It makes things, instead of having this large manuals on how Satipatthana is supposed to be practiced, you bring it down to a very simple and easy way of doing things. So I personally think that when the Buddha is talking about Satipatthana practice, what he means, the primary thing he means, is watching the breath. That's how it is explained in many places, just like here. You fulfill the Satipatthana. You don't just practice it, but you fulfill it all the way, all the four Satipatthana, everything here is completed by watching the breath. In other words, you don't have to do anything else. That is a complete course in meditation in its own right. So you may perhaps be wondering, those of you who know the Satipatthana Sutta, you know that in the Satipatthana Sutta, it starts off with mindfulness of breathing as part of the Kaya Vipassana. Kaya Vipassana is contemplation of the body, yeah, basically. So it starts off in there with mindfulness of breathing, and then mindfulness of breathing does not occur within the Vedana Vipassana, the Chitta Vipassana. The contemplation of feeling and mind. There's nothing there about mindfulness of breathing. It only belongs to the very first step right there. So how come in the Satipatthana Sutta, mindfulness of breathing only belongs with body contemplation, but in the Anapanasati Sutta, it actually belongs to everything, to the whole Satipatthana Sutta? What is going on here? There seems to be a contradiction. Yeah? And I think the answer to that contradiction is that the way Anapanasati is placed in the Satipatthana Sutta as part of the Kaya Nupasana, it doesn't actually belong there. Yeah, it shouldn't be there, and this is one of the things that you can find, again, when you do comparative study of the suttas in the various traditions, you find that there are certain parts of the Satipatthana Sutta that seem to be more original, seem to be more, it has been expanded later on, because all the Satipatthana Sutras and the various traditions, they differ quite a lot. So what is the most original one? And I think one of the original things is that Satipatthana did not include that section on mindfulness of breathing originally. Originally it was just body contemplation. Put one part of the body, four elements perhaps, that sort of thing. So what this points to is that my basic argument here is simply that all you have to do, which makes it so simple and so easy, is watching the breath. Watching the breath will take you all the way to the end of the Buddhist path. But just feeling all the four Satipatthana, everything is done by the simple act of watching the breath. Is that a relief? Does that kind of make things simple? Sometimes people always wonder about Satipatthana practice. Actually, that is all there is to it. Watch the breath in your business. So easy to say, that's all there is to it. But then people say, I can't watch the breath. Yes? What then? That makes things kind of a bit more tricky. If that's all there's to it, but you can't do it, then you have a problem. So that's what we're going to look at now, is how this actually comes about. But before we do that, then, because you fulfill the four Satipatthana, that means you also fulfill the seven factors of awakening. Yeah, and you remember the seven factors of awakening are all about samadhi practice. All the qualities in samadhi are part of those factors. It's piti, the joy, the prasanna, the tranquility, and the samadhi, and also the upeka, the equanimity of the mind at the very end. So again, Satipatthana fulfills, completes seven factors of awakening. So what this means again is that Satipatthana leads to samadhi and also includes samadhi, kind of means both at the same time. Yeah, so all of this comes together. And of course then, from the seven factors of awakening, that is where you have vijja and vimutti. Vijja being here translated as true knowledge, but I like the translation of insight. I think it's very nice for vijja, real insight, real understanding. And then vimutti being liberation at the very end. Yes. In English. And you don't want to call it Pali? I sure have. You have Pali in English. Okay, the first one, I'm going to call it Pali in English. First one is Sati Sampradaya, mindfulness factor of awakening. Yeah, and the Sati Sampradaya is roughly equivalent to Satipatthana. Yeah, so it says in the sutras, you practice Satipatthana, and then that kind of gives rise to the seven factors of awakening. And this is, you can see there again the causality between Satipatthana and seven factors of awakening. The very fact that the very first factor of awakening is Satipatthana, shows a close connection between the two sets, one leading on to the next one. Yeah? One of the things to understand about the Buddhanga is that they are also a causal sequence, one Buddhanga leading to the next one. So once you have the sati in place, then each factor leads on to the next one, all the way to the very last. So mindfulness factors of awakening, that leads to Dhammavicaya Sambuddhaka. Dhammavicaya is the investigation of phenomena. The factor of awakening, which is the investigation of phenomena. Dhammavicaya, investigation of Dhamma. Dhamma is like phenomena, or things, or principles as well. In other words, causality and all these kind of things. And that factor of awakening is all about understanding the qualities of the mind. Yeah? Which qualities of the mind are dark, which are bright, which are blameworthy, which are unblameworthy. Yeah? And that's what it is about. So really, the point here, once you understand the qualities of the mind, then that enables you to practice those qualities properly. Yeah? If you don't understand properly where the defilements are and where the pure states of mind are, you can't fulfill the purification of the mind. So this is very similar to the fourth Satipatthana. The fourth Satipatthana, you analyze very carefully the Buddhangas and also the five hindrances in order for you to overcome them. So you know what they are, you know how they causally arise, and you know how they kind of remain in existence later on, especially the Buddhangas. So you understand what are good and bad qualities, and then that enables you to practice it. Again, you can see the close relationship. I'm going to have to finish this question first. I'll get back to you in a second. You see the close relationship between Satipatthana and the seven Buddhangas. Second Sambuddhanga is very similar to the fourth Satipatthana. See the close relationship there. Once you understand these qualities, you're able to overcome them. Then, when you overcome these things, then the mind starts to get energized because the defilements would reduce the energy of the mind. So it is a very simple, like an energy factor of awakening, number three here. Yeah? The energy arising, the energy factor of awakening arises as a consequence of overcoming the problems of the mind. Usually together with the energy arising, you get the piti sambuddhaka, the piti being the joy or the rapture factor of awakening, joy factor of awakening, the fourth one. Energy and joy usually come together, and often they come together with mindfulness, and these things are very closely related to each other. And this is the way meditation starts to become really good fun, when piti starts to arise. You really come to enjoy yourself. You start to understand, really understand why you are on this path of meditation practice once these things happen. Then, as you practice your meditation, it starts to deepen. The coarser aspects of piti or joy, they fall away, and you are left with a deeper sense of satisfaction called tranquility factor of awakening. This is the fifth one. The pasati sambuddhaka, tranquility factor of awakening. Yeah, this is what you see now is the progress of meditation again. You see the process happening. This is your internal, this is the map, and you look for that internally when your meditation is really working. Yeah. And things, at this point, things get very, very powerful and beautiful when this happens. Yeah. And it's very attractive to do your meditation practice. Yeah. So things calm down, and eventually that calming down brings with it a much more deeper sense of satisfaction and happiness, which draws the mind in. And the mind becomes unified because of the powerful attraction of that state of mind. Yeah? And that is when you get the samadhi sambuddhaka, the stillness factor of awakening. Yeah? Don't call it the concentration factor of awakening because that is considered bad when I come from it. So stillness factor of awakening is better. Yeah? I think it is far preferable. So the samadhi happens. Why? Because it's so attractive. Drawn into the object, you don't want to do anything else. So all restlessness, all idea, desire, wanting to do anything else, all that falls by the wayside. All you want to do is stay with this one thing. And that means that samadhi happens. If one focuses in on that. And then, as you practice samadhi, the deeper the samadhi, the more equanimous your mind is. Until eventually you get to the fourth jhana, yeah? And that is the equanimity factor of awakening, the upekkha sambuddhaka, which is the seventh one. And all of these buddhakas, they happen in sequence. They are one cause of the next one, and as you're going through this, the cause of sequence happening. So that is the seven sambuddhakas. You got them all written down then? Yeah, you have it left? Yeah? Good? Okay. Yes, you want to ask something?
Just how you were saying about the opening of mindfulness.
Yeah.
Okay, when you explore the quality of the mind, does it happen at that current moment or is it overall?
It happens. I think it's probably a bit of both, but I think ideally it happens at that moment because you need quite strong mindfulness to be able to really explore the mind in depth. So I think, for example, it happens as part of the anapanasati, yeah, the mindfulness of breathing exercise. You do the mindfulness of breathing, yeah, and the information, you gather the information, so to speak, as you go through the process. And afterwards, when you kind of come out of your anapanasati, you look back on the process and you start to understand which aspects of mind were pure, which were impure, and all these kind of things. So it's a bit, as the process is happening, you're doing it there because you're actually seeing what's happening there. But afterwards, when you come out, that's when you kind of analyze it. So then you look at you look at what's actually going on, and you start to understand what's happening here. Yeah?
So basically, if your emotion is like in anger, during the exploration,
So let's say that again. If you get really strongly angry, then that's not really part of Satipatthana, because you have to kind of put aside the very, very powerful emotions first of all. Here we're talking about very refined things already. We've already got on the way down the path. But basically that's right. Let's say you get a little bit irritated or whatever, yeah? So you first of all, you know that there is a problem there. You know this is an issue, yeah? And sometimes you don't even know, because some of these defilements can be very subtle. But for example, sensual desire, if it is a core sensual desire, it's very obvious what's going on there. But if it is a very subtle sensual desire, it just means like a bit of attachment to the body. So you can't let go of the body 100%. Yeah? If it's a bit of attachment to the senses, so you can't let go of the senses. And that will hinder you from entering samadhi because of that attachment you hold on. So you start to understand how deep these defilements actually are, how far they go. And the more you understand that, the more ability you have to let go in the future and then let go of these things. Okay, anything else from that then? Yeah, so these are so, seven factors of awakening. And then that leads to insight and liberation. Liberation from suffering, liberation from defilements, and liberation from everything, really. So that is what that is about. So a very powerful thing, simply watching the breath. What happens after? What happens next is, this is what the Buddha has to say afterwards. And how, bhikkhus, is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? So here comes the actual practice. Now this is what we have to do. And one of the most important things with this whole practice here is actually the very first paragraph. Why? And the reason, because this sets up the practice. This is the background information that we need to understand whether you are ready to do mindfulness of breathing or not. And remember, as I said before, a lot of the meditation in Buddhism is meditation is an automatic process. One thing leading to the next one. And if there is an automatic process, and how you establish it at the beginning becomes so important, because that is what decides whether that automatic process gets started or not. Yeah, if you don't get the basics in place, the automatic process won't even get started then. So having the basics in place is so important. And so this is the basics. Here, the bhikkhu goes to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down. Having folded his legs crosswise, he sets his body erect and establishes mindfulness in front of him. And then ever mindful, he breathes out, mindful in him, and mindful he breathes out. So this part here is probably the most important part of the whole Anapanasati Sutta, at least as far as preparation goes. The rest is also important, but that's more important as a map to know that you're heading in the right direction. But this here tells you what is required for you to be able to do the practice. And the very first thing here, it starts off by saying here, the bhikkhu again, yeah? So the idea is focused on the monks, presumably because the Buddha gave most of his teachings to monks, and the monks would be in the majority, and all these kind of things. But again, it obviously refers to everyone, yeah? Whether you are a lay person, or a bhikkhuni, or a bhikkhu, whatever you are, it refers to everyone. And then you have this idea here, of going to the forest, or to the root of a tree, or an empty hut. And this is already quite significant. And what is the point of this? The point of this is to say all of these things, the root of a tree, forest, empty hut, these are places of seclusion. Places where you withdraw from society, you withdraw from the people around you. You go and stay by yourself. This is the purpose of it. So what it tells us that mindfulness of breathing is a quite a profound meditation. It's a meditation that really is only undertaken in solitude. Yeah, when you are kind of divorced, you are detached already from the people around you, and you're just enjoying being by yourself. That is when this meditation is undertaken. And that says a lot about mindfulness of breathing. It is not a simple thing. It is not some kind of basic exercise, and then we move on to something more advanced. Actually, it is the very essence of what this path is about. Solitude is everything, you know, the higher aspects of the Buddhist path, we always happen in solitude. And this is what this says right here. We do this in solitude. And this is why it is sometimes very useful to, go out to what's ordinary surroundings, get away from the ordinary things, and actually go on a retreat somewhere, do something different. Go at least in semi-solitude, even not 100%, at least semi-solitude, and see what that does for you. And see if it works. And if you are ready, If your mind is prepared, you have done your groundwork in the right way, you may find you really enjoy solitude. Yeah. Remember, solitude is not really an escape. People think, yeah, if you don't like anyone and you can't really get on with other people, then solitude is great, yeah, because you don't have to be around people you don't like. This is kind of one of the ideas that people sometimes have. But it doesn't work like that. Yeah, if you don't get along with people and you want to have solitude because you just prefer to be away by yourself, all these kind of things, then solitude is not going to work, because that negative feeling they have towards people is going to kind of bring that into the solitude. Rather, it is the person who actually kind of glides along very easily in ordinary life. Not someone who's perhaps, you don't have to be super friendly and extroverted and all that kind of stuff. That's not what it means. But a person who doesn't really have too much problems with people around them. You have a sense of metta and compassion for the world, yeah? And actually functions with ordinary people quite well. People who don't argue very much, but you just function with other people. The person who has that sense of metta in ordinary life, the ability to work with other people, is also the kind of person who's going to enjoy solitude. If you're just trying to get away from people because you can't stand to be around other people, then it is not really going to work. Yeah? And this is, I think, a very important thing to understand about solitude. You're not trying to escape. What you're trying to do is you're trying to remove yourself a little bit so as to enable the mind to calm down in a deeper sense. That is really what is going on here. And that is why solitude is so important. And solitude, what you find in that, it gives you that sense of distance to the world, yeah? Distance to people around you. You are removed from ordinary people. And that distance, that sense of separation, allows the attachment, the defilements, all of these things to die down. When you are around people all the time, all the attachment that we have, all the defilement that we have, tends to be kind of blossom a little bit. It's very hard for them to kind of die down properly. But when you're really by yourself, it's like people, the whole world kind of disappears, and it doesn't matter so much anymore. You kind of forget about it, and it kind of has a freeing aspect of the mind right there. And this is why in the sutta I was talking about the kaya viveka. First of all, you withdraw into solitude, yeah, the bodily seclusion. That allows the mental seclusion, the chitta viveka, to happen, precisely because you are withdrawn from the things of the world. You have cut those ties a little bit, but the mind state is actually much more positive as a consequence. So this is how this works, and why this is actually so important, because it frees up the mind, the seclusion, the physical seclusion in this way. That is part of it. The other part of it, which I mentioned before, the idea of why seclusion is so powerful, is simply because when you live in the city, when you are around people all the time, it tends to stir up the mind, stir up the sensuality. It's very hard to live in the city all the time, not disturbed up by the things. The advertisements, the people, the pubs, the bars, the restaurants, people messing around, the entertainments. Cities are playgrounds where people like to play and enjoy themselves. This is the problem with it. So you withdraw from that. And in nature, the mind tends to calm down. It tends not to be disturbed in the same way as it is in a city environment. This is a kind of important part of this as well. So it has this seclusion, and again, it tells you something about the profundity of anapanasati. Just the idea of watching the breath is a very profound practice. So you shouldn't be too surprised if you find it difficult, especially difficult to go deeper. You shouldn't be too surprised at that, because this is actually the suggestion by the Buddha how to do this. Yes, sir.
What about the saying, essence makes the heart go fonder?
Essence makes the heart go fonder, that's true. And I think this is also one of the reasons why actually going into solitude is good. Yeah? You go into solitude, you get a bit of distance from people. But you have to make it grow fonder in a good way. And a different way of making it grow fonder, you can make it grow fonder through attachment. You get more attached to the people around you. Or you can use an absence to just have more general metta. And often that works very well, because when you are around people all the time, it's quite difficult to have enough distance from them to really be able to have that metta, because they and this constant contact leads to a little bit of problems and irritation. So, once you kind of go into solitude, actually sometimes having met them is much more easy when you do that. So, you get more detached from people. Yeah, so that's a good thing. So you have met them in your daily life, but at the best of your ability, you have people around you, and then you can enhance that even more in solitude. So make sure when you have pondered, make sure you have the right kind of fondness, yeah? When you have the right fondness, and everything will is either right or wrong, yeah? So you have to have the right kind of fondness. Right fondness is a samma fondness, samma ratti or something like that. Yes. Okay. It also is a good point, yeah? It means that when you come back and you see your family after a week of retreat, yay, so that's just we get that. It helps. Okay, so you go to a place which is a little bit more empty, and many of you will already have noticed, just come here to the BGM, helps a little bit, yeah? Coming out of your house, coming out of your ordinary environment already helps a little bit. You have a little bit more seclusion for yourself than you have in your whole life. So already this is like a little bit of seclusion. So you can see how this works. And then you sit down, yeah? Another kind of important factor of meditation, of anapanasati, you do it while you sit. And I think this again shows you that it is a very profound practice. It's a practice that isn't really suitable for walking meditation or anything else. Lying down, maybe the Buddha doesn't mention lying down here, so probably better to sit up. So it shows you again something about the profundity of this. Because the idea is to become calm, the idea is to become peaceful, and any movement of the body will tend to disturb that peace to some extent. Yeah, so you sit down, and then this becomes possible. When you walk, do other kinds of meditation instead. So, and then you fold your legs crosswise. Yeah, so how important is that? Do you have to fold your legs crosswise? What does it mean if you can't attain anything on the path unless you fold your legs crosswise? Is that what it means? Maybe. Maybe not. It can be read that way. Yeah, many people insist that cross-legged is much better because when you're cross-legged, then you are following the instructions, the last dot. Yeah, everything you're following it all the way. Yeah? And it is true, you are following it all the way. But I think in this particular case, and this requires interpretation, and it's very hard to be absolutely sure about this. But from reading elsewhere in the suttas, I would say that the meaning of this here is that this was just the way people would sit in those days. If you go into the forest, you don't have any chair at the root of a tree, and there's no chair at the root of a tree. Usually not anywhere, unless you're very lucky that they must have come and put a chair there, but usually no chair at the root of a tree. So you go there, so you sit down cross-legged. There's no other way to sit, basically. Yeah, that's what you do. And that's how people would often sit in those days. And even, you know, as a brother, he was a young monk in the northeast of Thailand. People would often sit on the ground. This was a natural way of sitting. It was a very poor part of Thailand back in the early 70s or mid-70s. And that's how people would sit. Even at home, they would sit on the floor and cross their legs. And they would, that's how things were. They obviously had a few chairs, but often they would sit on the ground. So people were used to that. That was a standard way of sitting. That was considered comfortable, yeah? That's how people were at ease. There is place in the sutta where someone says, oh, I'm not really relaxed at ease unless I can sit cross-legged. And that shows you that that was kind of the standard way of doing things. So what matters here is not the actual posture, I think. That is not really the point. The point is to be comfortable, to be at ease, to be relaxed, so you actually can let go of the body. That is the point. Remember, the body, meditation has nothing to do with the body. The body is something you want to get out of the way. The body is a problem. Yeah, so once you get the body out of the way, that is when meditation becomes possible. So that is really the most important thing. So ask yourself, how can you get the body out of the way? What is the best posture for you? So the body is no longer an issue. It doesn't give rise to any problems. I've neither indulged the body, nor have you tormented the body. But if I beautiful middle way where the body just disappears. The body is no problem anymore. But the body, the disappearing body is the right kind of body. Right? Disappearing, and then the senses come to go with it, yeah? Gradually, gradually. That is the right thing. Yeah? So that is what you should look out for. And sometimes what that means is that you can change your posture, yeah, during a retreat. Sometimes you may wish to sit cross-legged. I find sitting cross-legged quite comfortable. But even for me, after a while, I get fed up sitting cross-legged. Yeah? After a while, I get pains and problems. And everybody had that problem at some stage. But if you want to sit cross-legged for a while, it's often, it can often be a very nice thing to do. It's called the Burmese posture, where you sit with your legs in front of you like this. And then you can, if you wish, you can lean back, or you can sit straight, it doesn't really matter, whatever works for you. And then when this becomes uncomfortable after a couple of hours, or an hour or whatever it is, then you just change your posture to do something else. Sit on a chair, whatever it is okay. I know some very good meditators who sit on chairs. Anyway, what do you want?
Yes, the phrase that translated as cross-legged,
yeah.
I checked the dictionary, it also says divan, sofa, couch.
Yeah, it means both.
Both.
Palanka is the Pali
yes.
word. Palanka means, yeah, it means cross-legged, but it also means like a sofa or a yeah.
chair.
So yeah, so it's probably it's comfortable, yeah?
Yeah.
Because the sofa is supposed to be comfortable then. That's probably exactly, that's a good point. So probably refers to comfort, yeah. Yeah.
Thanks to Ajahn Brahm.
Sorry?
Thanks to Ajahn Brahm's word of the Buddha.
Ah, he said that, didn't he?
Sit down comfortably.
Down comfortably, okay, yeah. And that's an interesting point. So that probably means that there might be a connection between the two. It actually means you are comfortable, you are at ease, yeah. So that is a... Just it's a small point, but an important one, and I think it matters enormously if people are going to enjoy the meditation practice or not, and we don't take these things wrong, literally in the wrong way. And then it says, so if you sit down, having folded your legs crosswise, palankam, a bujitra or something like that, you set your body straight, yeah, uchu is the Pali word. The word uju, quite literally, is actually the same meaning as straight in English. It's actually the same word, the root is the same. But right and uju and straight is all actually comes from the same root. So quite literally means you set your body straight. So but remember that what we are doing here is all about doing things at the right time in the right place. Yeah? So setting your body erect. Here it is all in conjunction with beginning ready for mindfulness of breathing. So it really depends on whether you're ready for the mindfulness of breathing or not. So it's all about the right time and place. And as I said before, many of the people I know who are the best meditators, when they start out, especially if you meditate in your daily life, yeah, and you are perhaps coming back home, you are tired, have a long day at work, and then you have all these things that you have done, very often you just need to relax first of all. Yeah, really relax. Even if you are in monastics, you do these things. You relax first of all. You sit back and you just wait and you allow the mindfulness to arise first of all. So remember, everything is about time and place. Yeah? If you force yourself to sit straight away and you are already a bit tense, the chances of letting go of the tension is much less because it keeps staying sitting straight already tends to be as likely you have to force yourself a little bit. First of all, relax all the tension out of yourself. Yeah? Then allow the mindfulness to arise. And then when the mindfulness arises, it's almost as if you want to sit straight, it's almost like the body demands of you to sit straight. So then you kind of straighten almost by yourself. Yeah? It happens almost automatically because it feels nice when mindfulness is already there. It feels really nice to sit straight because it enhances that mindfulness and makes it even stronger. If you slump, the mindfulness tends to kind of slack a little bit. When you sit straight, it enhances that. The time and place, yeah, is so important here. So don't be afraid of experimenting a little bit. It's much more important to understand the kind of the broad areas how meditation works. If you understand broadly how it works, you can make the little decisions about how to sit and how to do from your own experience. And the question should always be, what actually appeals at ease? How do you feel at ease? How does mindfulness arise together with a sense of ease, a sense of enjoying what is going on? And this is kind of the broad picture. And once you know that, then you can kind of adjust things a little bit according to your own experience. It's important not to be too robotic in meditation practice. And I think this is sometimes the problem with all these methods where you are told exactly what to do to the last point. It's like it's too programmed. But we are different. People are not all the same. We are at different stages of the path. We cannot all be squeezed into one program which is exactly the same for everyone. Because what that means is that some people may fit very well for it, but others that may be hopeless for it. And then they will quit meditation and will never come back. Yeah, that's what they say. Some of these meditation needs only 10% come back, and the rest never, never see them again because it's too much dukkha. And they kind of disappear. And they have enough. Yeah. And this is unfortunate. It's very unfortunate because meditation has this incredible potential for being such an enormous service to each one of us if we do it in the right way and we practice correctly. And this is really what we, you know, what we want to do. We want to get this potential, use this beautiful technique for something positive rather than being trapped into a system that doesn't really work. And, you know, if you go to some of these retreats and then you ask questions like, well, you know, this is happening to me, and all you get is kind of the answer you tend to get is, well, just do it this way, and this is the way, and follow the program, this is the program, this is what you're supposed to do. And there's very little flexibility often, because it has been established as a program. But I think the Buddha doesn't establish these things in such precise way. It's more open, it's more open to flexibility, to actually, you have the broad framework, and then you, it's up to you to decide how you use that broad framework in your particular case. It takes a bit of experimenting. You know, initially you may be a bit uncertain, but over time these things tend to come together. So think about it like that, and again you are thinking about these things in the right way. You have the right attitude to it. So you set your body erect, but you know when to do that, how to do it. And then comes the final one here, which is kind of the most important one of all. Having established mindfulness in front of you. Yeah, this is, in other words, having, you know, you will see that having folded his legs and having set the ball erect, having established mindfulness. The Pali word that is used here is a particular type of verbal tense, which means that this action happens first. Yeah, so before you get to anasanati, before you watch your breath, you establish your mindfulness. That's the meaning of this. And this is why I put so much emphasis on the, you know, just relaxing and allowing mindfulness to arise and feeling at ease and enjoying yourself even before you start watching the breath. Then watching the breath comes afterwards. Once you have a degree of clarity, once your mind is relatively peaceful, then watching the breath actually becomes quite natural and quite easy. You don't have to use too much willpower. But if you do it in the right order, you will find that actually can become very unpleasant. Some people who watch the breath, either they're just thinking all the time and watch the occasional breath every now and again, or they kind of watch the breath but they feel really tense and unpleasant about it, and the whole exercise becomes useless. And it becomes again a recipe for giving it all up. So how do we establish mindfulness in front of you? The first thing that you will notice here is this word in front of you, which is interesting. What is this Palimokkam? And there's a lot of scholarly articles written on the exact meaning of this word Palimokkam. This is what scholars do. They take one word out of the Pali Canon and they write an enormous piece list of this one word. And sometimes it can be quite useful, because sometimes some individual words are very crucial for understanding the process of the path and how the path works. And this word Palimokkam actually turns out to be quite crucial, because a lot of how we watch the breath is actually based on this one word. And this is why when you go to certain meditation teachers, they will tell you to watch the breath here. Yeah? Why do they say that? Because of the word Palimokkam. That is why they say that. This word is responsible for that particular instruction. And then you read the commentaries and all these things, and they will have different ideas of what Palimokkam means. And that's where this whole thing arises from. But it is, I think, it is not at all clear that this is the actual meaning of Palimokkam. And you will see some of the people who have studied this in detail, they have argued that actually that is not really the meaning. Palimokkam probably more just means in the present moment, right here in front of you. Yeah? Pari, hukka, hukka means the face or the mouth, it can mean either one. Pari has a sense of kind of all around or everywhere, so kind of in the presence of your face or mouth. I think the right approach, I believe, is not to focus too strictly on any particular part of the body, but actually just to have mindfulness present, mindfulness in the here and now, relating to your body. And then when you breathe in, and you can easily know that you breathe in. Yeah, everyone can know that. Breathe in, it's pretty obvious. Breathe out, that is very easy to know. But try to feel your breath here. Actually, for many people it's very hard, because they're not sensitive enough. You can't really feel anything, or it's just too focused and too narrow, so you become tense because you're trying to feel it there. So I like the idea. This is Adam Brown's method as well, and I think actually it accords perfectly with what is being said here. All you have to do is know whether the breath goes in or whether the breath goes out. You don't have to relate it to any part of the body. Breath going in, breath going out, that's all you have to know. And if you know that, then you are already practicing. That is the right approach, I think, to practicing Anapanasati. You can watch here as well. I don't think it's wrong if you watch it on the upper lip or the nose. I think it's okay. If you wish, you can do that. But just make sure that you are relaxed about it and that you are enjoying it. That is not really lacking. So that is the Parimokkha. And then having established mindfulness, what does that mean? What it means is that there's two kind of ways of establishing mindfulness. One is the short-term establishing of mindfulness, what you do in the present moment. Yeah. So what do you do now to establish mindfulness? Well, what you do is you kind of sit back, yeah, and you allow things to be. You stop doing so much, because a lot of the doing activity is what draws the mind out of the present moment. So you sit back, yeah. You allow things to be, you allow things to settle down, you don't do anything anymore, you become the passive observer, and that passive observer is actually what allows mindfulness gradually to arise. So you just have to be very patient. This is one of the problems. Sometimes you sit there for half an hour and your mind is just thinking this way and that way. But don't allow that to disturb you. Don't try to force the mind to stop thinking whatever. Just be very patient and just wait. And eventually, this is what happens with me anyway, I think it happens with many people, eventually the mind starts to calm down. Even if it's been very active, it starts to calm down. You come into the breath and things start to become, you come to the present moment and things become very beautiful as a result. So just patience, yeah? Patience, waiting in the present moment, being a passenger on the train, all of these kind of things. And how to do that, mindfulness just comes all by itself. It's like a miracle. It just appears out of nowhere. Why? Because you're putting in the causes instead of trying to force mindfulness into existence, which is also possible. Then you can force yourself to be present. And after a while, you feel really tired as a result. Instead, you allow natural mindfulness to arise, which is very easy, very present, and very natural when that happens. So the body disappears. You try to have a little bit of the right attitude, yeah? So you're enjoying, you have a positive attitude to what is happening, and you allow the doer to gradually fade away. And these are all methods, ways of allowing mindfulness to arise naturally. And you can't afford to be impatient, yeah? This is really patience practice, number one, and you just sit back and wait, and then things happen. So this is why sometimes mindfulness of breathing or all this is quite hard to do in daily life. Sometimes all you have to do is be satisfied with a little bit of peace, a little bit of quiet, yeah? And if a little bit of mindfulness arrives, it's wonderful. But already you're doing very well if you can do that much in daily life. So don't expect too much. Don't expect to get kind of lots of bliss and happiness in your daily meditation, because you may just end up being disappointed if you do that. So this is the short-term establishing of mindfulness. This is what we do in ordinary practice. But in the long term, the idea of establishing mindfulness is all those things that I've been talking about so far. This is why I've been talking about all these things, about how to deal with the mind, how to overcome anger and desires, how to reflect on impermanence, how to make the present moment important and significant. Yeah, this idea that everything you do in your life is for the purpose of watching your breath and for practicing the spiritual path. That changes your outlook, it changes your attitude, it changes your priorities. And that enables that mindfulness in the long run to come around. And as you practice the other factors of the Noble Eightfold Path in daily life, in all of these things, then what happens every time you come back on a meditation retreat, you find something has happened to your mindfulness. It is now more powerful. It is more clear. There's less distractions there than there were 6 months ago, last time you went on a retreat, a year ago, whatever. Why? Because you have been purifying yourself. You have learned to have the right attitude to other people, the right attitude to the situations in life. You're more positive about things, less fault-finding, yeah? And all of this together is what enables mindfulness to arise. This is like the long-term approach for mindfulness. So these two things, when they come together, the short-term application of mindfulness and the long-term thing, then you have established mindfulness. And this is why I'm saying that it is much more important in the long run, much more important to have purity about yourself, how you deal with your mind, how you live your life. Your morality, your ethics are far more important than the number of hours you sit on your cushion to do meditation practice. Far more important, because those are the supporting factors for meditation. Just sitting on sitting down on the cushion, if it doesn't do anything for you, it's not going to really have much effect for your meditation later on. But if you use the sitting down on your cushion to gain a bit of clarity, to enable you to be more kind, to be a better person in daily life, then you are doing it in the right way, because you are building up the supporting factors that eventually will lead to mindfulness, and then will enable you to watch the breath and take this whole practice to a higher level. This is how it works, yeah. This is why, how all of these things come together. When you are a good person, a kind person, the present moment becomes the present moment. It's nice to be here because you feel good about yourself. Then mindfulness can arise. Everything kind of comes together. So having established mindfulness, yeah, remember that. Having, in other words, is a prerequisite. This is what the Buddha is basically saying here. So the prerequisite, having established mindfulness, then what do you do? Only then, yeah, when you have it established in front of you, only then do you ever mindful you breathe in, mindful you breathe out. And here, this is a small little thing that has to do with translation. And I don't know how interested you are in translating from Pali into English, but if you are interested in that, then a little thing like the word ever there. And where does that word ever come from? And where it comes from, when you read the Pali, it says the word is eva in the Pali. I can't remember how the Pali goes now. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So the word is eva, yeah? And so the question is, how do you translate this word eva? Is it ever correct? So you have to know what's going on quite well to actually be able to make this kind of judgment. Is ever really the right translation here? And the problem with ever is that what we are seeing here is the progress of mindfulness of breathing. And as your mindfulness of breathing becomes more profound, your ability to be aware of what is happening is becoming ever deeper. Yeah. So ever mindful doesn't belong to the beginning. You don't have an ever mindfulness at the very beginning. That comes further down. So it doesn't seem right to have that at the very start. So the word eva in Pali, it can mean either ever, it can mean intensified, which kind of means ever, or it can mean just. Yeah, just mindful you breathe in, just mindful you breathe out. And that, I think, is the right and translation in this context. It is not that you are ever mindful, because that comes from the Dhamma path. It is that you are just mindful. So what does that mean, just mindful? And what it means is that the only thing that you have to do to practice mindfulness of breathing is to be present. Yeah? You don't actually do anything. You don't actually have to use your willpower. You don't force these things into existence. There's no agency on your part. Your part is just to be passive. You are the recipient of information, the recipient of awareness of what what's going on around you, the recipient of just the experience. But you're not the doer, you're not someone who actually makes this thing happen. You are just mindful, but nothing else is happening here. Yeah, that I think is an appropriate translation in this case. You can see sometimes how little subtle things like that actually can make a little bit of difference. Not often, but sometimes it can. This is one of those cases. Yes?
We use just in our Pali.
Excellent. Much better. Yeah. So that's right. So you are. Where did you get that from? Who taught you that?
One of the Bhaktis.
One of the Bhaktis.
Do the translation.
Okay.
Why we always use it.
Just, yeah. It doesn't always mean just necessarily. It can mean different things. So I'll repeat the question. So you said that in your Pali classes, you always translate eva as just. Yeah. But it can mean, this is one of the things about Pali words, it can mean different things in different contexts. So eva means, very often it means just, you're quite right, or only, or just, or something like that. But in certain contexts, it can be an intensifier. And if it is an intensifier, then something like ever would be right in this kind of context. So it depends a little bit. So this is kind of the trick of translation, is to know which is the right translation at a particular point in time.
Maybe you have to read the whole sentence, and it makes more sense than just looking at the word.
Yes. Yeah, you have to read it. Not, but even the whole sentence is sometimes enough. So sometimes I have to read all the 40 kinds. Yeah, you have to see the different context, different places, how it is used here and there, and then it starts to come together. So the more experience you have with Pali, the more you know the overall usage of this kind of word. That is really what you need at the end of the day. Yeah.
I don't see the word ever. So satova asasati.
Ah, yeah. So satova, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so so is he.
Yeah.
Yeah. So satova. And then, yeah, okay. Okay. Okay, thank you very much. Like, this is so good to have people have everything there. Yeah, it's really cool. I don't translate because they have the English on there. Yeah. So satova asasati. Satova. This is different.
Oh, is it?
Ah, it has va in two places. I think that this must be peculiar to this version of that sutta. Anyway, yeah, so so is he. Sato is mindful, yeah? It's from sati. So, and then you have the va, it's a short version of eva, it's contracted because it goes together, because it's a junction form of eva. So, mindful, just mindful, he, asatati, he breathes in, mindful, he breathes out. So there you are, yeah. Thank you very much for bringing these things there. That's very, very good of you. Okay, so it's a slightly interesting point. It means that all you are is you are mindful. There's nothing you have to do, no agency that is required on your part. It is kind of a nice thing about this. So that is, now we are ready for mindfulness of breathing. Yeah, we have kind of established the groundwork. So any comments, any more comments about that? This is what we've been doing for the last few days, is establishing exactly why I have kind of taught this class in this way. Because I wanted to tease what that groundwork actually is before we get to mindfulness of breathing. Now you know why mindfulness of breathing is not as straightforward as it may seem. Yeah? It takes a lot of preparation to get there. Any comments on this? Does it make sense? Yeah, you understand? Yeah, that's great. This is kind of one of the sutras that is very easy to learn by heart. You can learn the Pali by heart because it's very repetitive. You know one thing, you know something else, you go on and on that. Okay, so let us then move into the actual practice and see what happens, how this is done. Now it gets really exciting. You have done all your hard work, you know, in your ordinary life, but you are kind to people, you don't do anything bad, you even think kind thoughts. Not always, let's face it, it's very hard to always think kind thoughts. But generally speaking, you think kind thoughts, and that already is very powerful and very nice. Yeah, if you can do that, I'm sure. So you do all of these things, you put in the whole hard work. And this is one of those things about the Buddhist path. The hardest, most difficult work is at the beginning of the further down the path you come, the more automatic it is, the easier things are. Yeah? It is kind of overcoming our bad habits at the beginning. That is the hardest thing to do. But now it just has to become easy. Now you just have to chill. Yeah, this is the thing. You get to this point, all you have to do is relax and sit back. And this is one of those things about this idea of an automatic process that we've been seeing again and again and again. One thing just leading to another one, it means there's nothing to do. Satova, just mindful, no will required. You just sit back and you see the process happening. That is such a wonderful thing because it's such a different way of getting results than what we are used to in the world. In the world, results come about because we do, because we are agents in our life, because we ensure that the result happens. Here is the exact opposite. You sit back, and the less you do, the more results you have. It's completely the inverse of what we are used to do. And this is why sometimes it is so hard, yeah? Precisely because it is the inverse of what we have to do. But this is the process that happens now. Actually, before I do that, I'm going to have a little bit of coffee. Will you forgive me if I have a little bit of coffee? Do it with mindfulness. Okay, thank you for your advice. I feel a bit bad about it because here I sit drinking coffee and you have to sit there watching me drinking coffee. Please don't get jealous. That's the time I'm going to have, so what's your mind? I'm being very naughty now. Please. This is not naughty. Serious. What does he mean? Is it, and I get, I've been with him for 20, almost 24 years, I think, without the Ram, I still don't know whether it's joking or being serious. I think that is kind
English.
Of, it's also very nice in a certain way. Anyway, so let us start with the real part of the Anapanasati Sutta. This sutta takes a long time, and this is why we have all these hours today to look at it, which is great. So, breathing in long, he understands that I breathe in long. Breathing out long, he understands I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands I breathe in short. Of breathing out short, he understands I breathe out short. So this is the very first part here, just being aware of the breath. Understanding here really means you just know the breath, you know what's going on. You will see in the next one here, it says trains. Yeah? You train to calm the breath. Here it just has understands. Why does it have understands here and train to the next one? Why that difference? And the difference is, I think, again, you have to sort of go from a bit of experience to know what is probably likely to be meant here. But you are already mindful, excuse me, because you are already mindful, you just know naturally whether your breath is long or short. Yeah, it just happens. Because you're already mindful, you don't actually have to train, you don't have to do anything more to have that knowledge. It already happens as it is. This is being recorded as well,
yeah?
Yeah. Oh dear.
Can't take it out.
So, you don't actually need to do anything more. You already have that awareness there. Your mindfulness is already present. So because of that, you are able to know when your breath is long or your breath is short. Yeah, so this is kind of the why it is understand that this thing. But the reason why it is trained in the next one is because the next step is not automatic. Yeah, the next step you actually need to stay with it for a while, you need to carry on for a while. You don't need to do anything in particular, but you need to be patient, you need to have the perseverance and commitment to the breath to be able to go on to the next stage. And that's why the next one is called trains, where this one is just called understands. You already have the ability to be aware of the breath there. So long and short breath, what does that actually mean? Does it mean that you kind of you make your breath long, you make your breath shorter? This is actually quite not an uncommon interpretation that you deliberately make your breath long and shorter. But there's nothing here to say that. In fact, my whole point of this word aim at the beginning, just mindful, is precisely that you don't make anything here. You allow everything to be here. You take the will out of the equation then. Remember from one of the first sutras that we had to look at the beginning, was the sutra on volition, which says that na chetanaya karaniya, this cannot be done, performed by will, chetana, being the will or the intention of Buddhism. And so the whole process of meditation cannot be done by willpower. It is an automatic process. One step goes automatically into the next one. So here, the idea of long and short breath just means that you are aware of the breath, regardless of its quality, yeah? You don't need to know, it's not about noting either. You don't have to sit there thinking, long breath, short breath, short breath, yeah? That also is superfluous. I know that this is a common technique being used. Maybe it may very well work for some, but it's not what the Buddha says we should be doing here. So, I don't mean to criticize on the technique, I just mean to point out whether it is supported in the sutras or not directly. I'm not saying that these techniques are wrong, I'm just saying there is no real direct evidence for it in the sutras that this is what you should be doing. So I think the best way is just to have awareness of the breath, yeah? Just to be aware, make it very simple, and then it's easy, it's nice, and it's kind of pleasant when you do it that way. So why is it long first and short afterwards? And this, I think, part of this is because this is often how the breath will appear when you have do mindfulness breathing properly. Once you start relaxing, you're going to breathe in and have a long breath. Yeah, you're finally relaxing, finally finding at ease. But then as your meditation goes deeper, the breath actually becomes shorter again. Yeah, there's quite a common experience when your breath meditation works. words and the like that. And I think that is why long first and short afterwards. Another alternative way of looking at it is just that awareness just points to the fact that you know the breath, yeah? If you know it's long or short, it means that you are aware of every breath because you know the quality of that breath. And it doesn't really matter so much exactly what kind of breath it is. So that is what is happening here. You just have knowledge of the breath. Still, your mindfulness is not super sharp, yeah? Just knowing the breath, whether it's long or short, doesn't take that much mindfulness. It takes quite a bit, actually, because often you forget the breath altogether. But it doesn't take super sharp mindfulness. And this is what happens at the next step here. Mindfulness is getting sharper. Yes, please.
You mentioned earlier that you would train the need that is most often a hindrance.
Yeah.
You think the word train is used here.
Yeah.
You think the word train that we use here means it's not often a hindrance.
Yeah, what I... What I meant is that if you are already mindful, then straight away you are able to know when the breath is long or short. You don't have to do anything more. That's available to you straight away. But the next step here, which is being aware of the whole body of the breath, is actually you need to take some time, some persistence to stay with the breath for a while before that happens. It doesn't happen straight away. Yeah, you need to stay with the breath for a while. It doesn't mean you need to use any willpower. No. It just takes a bit of time before you get to that stage. That's what I meant. I don't mean that you use the will. It's just time consuming. That's what I meant to say. Yeah. So this is the next stage here, and this is called as follows. I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole volume of breath. He trains us, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of breath. So what is going on here is that your mindfulness is becoming sharper. Yeah? And this is one of those things that the Buddha's path is the mindfulness always becoming sharper and sharper and sharper until eventually it is so sharp that together with samadhi it enables you to see things according to reality. People sometimes think that mindfulness is either you're mindful or you're not. It's like on or off, but it actually is much more complex than that. It's also the sharpness of mindfulness, the quality of mindfulness. You can be present, but you can be super present. Yeah? You can be super duper present. It's like many degrees of presence, depending on how powerful the mindfulness is. It's not just your ability to be aware, it's the depth of your awareness. And this is what you are saying here, the depth of the awareness is increasing. So you start to be able to see the breath in its entirety. You see more clearly what is going on in the breath. You don't just see short and long, but you see all the aspects of the breath, all the parts of the breath, everything that is happening. This is a sign of increased mindfulness. One of the interesting questions here is, what exactly is meant again by the Pali here? Sabbakaya Patisamvedi is the Pali behind this. And sabbakaya, sabba is the whole, kaya means like body in Pali. Actually, kaya is a very multifaceted word. It means a group of things, a conglomeration of things, but it very often refers to the body, like the body being a conglomeration of the 31 parts or whatever. So here it means experiencing the whole body. What exactly does that mean? And sometimes it is understood to mean referring to the whole physical body, quite literally. Yeah? This is what the Goenka tradition usually refers to, understands it to mean it. Is that necessarily the right way of looking at it? And I personally don't think so. And of course, again, being as a Brahma disciple, as what Brahma says as well, so I kind of follow, as a dutiful disciple, I follow along it. But as a Brahma says about this, and I think he must be right, because what he said makes very good sense. We are doing breath contemplation here. Everything here is about watching the breath all the way through, and then suddenly in the middle of it, you're supposed to watch the body. It doesn't really make any sense. It makes much better sense if this also is part of the breath contemplation. Yeah, and the commentary explains to me in breath contemplation. If you come to the end of the sutta, I haven't actually included it here. I probably should have included it actually, because like it quite nice. But at the very end of the Kaya and Vipassana section, the section, the first tetrad, Vanapanasati, it specifically says that the body is one type of body among all bodies. Yeah, because the word Kaya does not mean physical body, it means a group of phenomena being put together. Yeah, like a body of evidence. Because a body of evidence is a group of evidence, in fact, accumulation of evidence. Because it is accumulation of various phenomena, it can refer to anything. And here it refers to the accumulation of phenomena called breaths, all kinds of breaths. Yeah? So, and that's what the sutta says directly at the end. It says this is one type of body among all kinds of bodies. So it seems, to me, it seems fairly obvious that it must refer to the breath. But when we talk about the sabbakaya patisamvedi, we're referring to experiencing the whole breath. I know many people who don't look at it that way, who regard it as watching the whole body, and sometimes get into discussions with them. I was going to say arguments, discussions, it's very civilized. There's discussions with them. And it's interesting. What you often find is that it may not matter all that much which way you interpret these things. So if your meditation is going well, even if you go to the body, the next step after that is actually calming down the breath. And everybody agrees on that. So if you, like, in the meantime, you go to the physical body or you go to the whole breath, as long as you're able to move on to the next stage and carry on the instruction, that is really the important part. Yeah. So. I don't think it's necessary to worry too much about it, but certainly to me it makes much better sense if we're dealing with a breath meditation all the way along. And that's how I prefer to understand it, in accordance with also the way Ajahn Brahm sees this. And of course then, once you have understanding the whole body of the breath, you come to the next stage here, which is as follows. I shall breathe. He trains us in tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains us as shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. Kaya santaran patisambadi, something like that. So, again, it's kind of strange. Yeah? Why does it use the word bodily formation? Formation, actually, better translation is activity, bodily activity, you know, sankhara, it means to create, it means activity, and all these kind of things. And once you translate it as activity, it makes more sense, because obviously the breath is an activity of the body. Yeah, it's something that happens, it's an activity, within, without, it's going on. So once you see it that way, it becomes more clear that this is actually what it refers to. And in fact, in other places in the sutra, it is specifically defined as the breath. Kaya sankhara is said to mean the breath, yeah? So it's fairly clear that that's what it means. But you can see that, but sometimes actually it's quite hard to understand this when you read it on your own. If you read that, tranquilizing the bodily formation, it is not obvious what it meant. Yeah, it can be quite confusing, and you read it and you think, what's going on here? And this is, of course, is the idea of having, you know, somebody with experience in the sutta to be able to show you what these things mean. So, I suspect that in ancient India, it would have been fairly obvious, because these words would have been used with a certain idiom in a certain way. People would have understood it. And now, because we translate quite literally, we don't really understand what's going on anymore, because it's just too hard to grasp that. Tranquilize the bodily formation, to me, means almost nothing. What does it mean, tranquilize the bodily formation? It's really hard to understand that, yeah. It's not because I'm completely stupid, I don't understand, is it? I don't think so anyway, that's my hope, not otherwise. It makes me feel bad about myself, I'm not stupid. It's not that, it's not the real reason. The real reason is simply because it doesn't have much meaning in English. It's very hard to grasp it. So, it's always helpful to have some guidance in reading the sutras, at least sometimes. A lot of it can be read on your own, it's very obvious. Some of the things are a bit more obscure, and this is one of those things. So again, to tranquilize the bodily formation, you train. Again, it doesn't mean that there's much that you have to do. Yeah, if you sit back, if you are able to be completely passive, if you are the passenger on the train rather than the conductor on the train, then the calming down, the tranquilizing of the breath happens all by itself. So you just watch it happening. Yeah? Calming down, calming down, calming down. And it's a wonderful thing when you see this, you see how you, the less you control, the less of a conductor you are in your life, the more beautiful life becomes, the more beautiful the world becomes, the more beautiful everything becomes. It's such a natural, easy way of living here, just having awareness and nothing else. And things calm down, the breath becomes very, very, very nice. Yeah, and at this point, things start to become very interesting. This is when we come to start with the second tetrad. The second tetrad being then moving on to the Vedana Vipassana. So what we have looked at now is equivalent in the suttas to Kaya Vipassana. When the Satipatthana Sutta divides up into four Satipatthanas, yeah? The first one being Kaya Vipassana, contemplation of the body. These four things that we have looked at now, the first four of the 16 steps, one quarter of the Anapanasati Sutta, is equivalent to Kaya Vipassana. This is how we do the contemplation of the body according to the Anapanasati Sutta. This is how you fulfill that. This is what we have looked at now. Now we are ready to move on to the Vedana Vipassana. But I'm not going to start that now because it's just too much. We'll be going on for almost an hour and a half already. And I'm going to start saying silly things very soon if I keep on going too much longer. Because after a while, the mind just doesn't work anymore. Is there any further comments or questions about that? About this process? Yeah, everything kind of makes sense? Excellent, sir. So, if there is no more, please, if you have any questions you'd like to ask, you can always write them down as well. And we'll have one more Q&A session this evening. To finish it, round everything off. Okay, so let's take a break and have a nice lunch, and we'll see you back again at 3 o'clock this afternoon.